Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Lickin' on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update providing up-to-the-minute information on interest rates, loan programs, and hot industry news relating to the mortgage industry. Brought to you by Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level. To participate in today's program, our guest call-in line is 646-716-4972. And now, here is your host of Lickin' on Lending, David Lickin.
To have you with us. It's an important broadcast. We've got a lot to talk about CFPB. As if, you know, we talk about Europe, we talk about the markets, we talk about how to be more profitable, but I'll tell you what CFPB is turning on out there for churning out as far as it relates to new regulations is the subject of this broadcast. We appreciate you tuning in this week. It is February 4th. It is Monday, and we're thrilled that you're making this a part of your way of staying up on all that's going on across the mortgage landscape, and certainly there is. We have later on in the broadcast Phil Shulman of K&L Gates with us. He is undisputedly an expert in this area. He used to be at HUD, and we're thrilled to have him be here giving us an update. Most of you know Phil very well, and can't wait to get him on in the Hot Topics segment a little bit later. I want to say thank you to all your listeners, all you listeners that tell your friends about the broadcast and share links about the broadcast. We appreciate it so very much. The Blog Talk Radio, which hosts this, is having some just converted to a new website, and there's some issues with the website, so we're not able to put up that good, handsome-looking picture of Phil just yet that we have and do a write-up on the radio. So several of you contacted me and say, can't see what the broadcast is about. Well, they launched a new website, and they got some glitches, obviously. So apologize for that. We'll have that all the content back up there shortly. But you can go down and listen to the broadcast, download them. Go to the www.lickinonlending.com, and you will be able to see all the broadcasts are still there, and the audio for this will be there, and the write-up hopefully will as soon as they fix this glitch. Appreciate our sponsor, UGI, United Guarantee, is out there as a sponsor. We appreciate so much their sponsorship to make this radio program possible. Have you been in contact with your UGI rep lately? They have got some new programs, some things that they're doing that are new to the industry that I'm very excited about, and I encourage you to get to know them. And if you have not connected with your UGI rep, I keep saying UGI, I know it's United Guarantee rep, I strongly recommend you to do so and talk to them about what exciting things they have going on in the marketplace. So, again, thank you to everyone there at United Guarantee for being a part of this broadcast and making it possible. Appreciate all of you. And now let's get into the hot topic of rates. Joe Farr, good to have you with us.
Good morning, Dave.
What do you have? What's going on in the markets?
Well, it's been a crazy week, let me tell you, including today. We're up nicely today. We're up about 11/32 on the day, and we've already seen favorable price changes from some lenders. Not much going on really to drive it today, other than, you know, the Dow's been running so far so fast, they're giving back some, and I think the MBS markets are benefiting from that. But there was a little strange news out of Europe. The Prime Minister of Spain, he's caused a stir in that there are allegations he's taking on money under the table for something. And, boy, you can only imagine how mad that'd make the citizens of Spain when they're trying to accept austerity measures to hear something like that. If it's true, who knows if it's true. But not a big deal, really, unless the result of this is that he's forced to resign because there's really not anyone behind him that's got a strong coalition, and it could be a while before they get their government back in order. So that's something we'll have to pay attention to. It's not as big a market driver as what was going on in Europe and its impact on our markets like it was back in the summer, but we will have to pay attention to that.
No,
but Dave, last week, I don't know, I need to go back and look at last week's show, but I think I said it's going to be a pretty crazy week,
and
it was. Let me tell you, it was an extremely volatile week last week. Not a huge movement one way or the other, just a lot of volatility. I went back and looked at one of the larger lenders that puts out correspondent price sheets, and they had their usual one a day, but they had nine more.
Nine.
So during the week,
wow,
there were nine reprices issued. And, yeah, there was one every day, at least one every day. In fact, one day they had four. So it's, it was a very, very volatile week. It started on Monday with a strong durable orders number, and it sent MBS prices lower and resulted and then after that, I mean, that's sort of the volatility. MBS prices open lower, and then pending home sales are weaker than expected, and they turn around completely, and favorable price changes come. Then on Tuesday, investors bought stocks and sold bonds ahead of the Fed meeting, and unfavorable price changes occurred on Tuesday. Wednesday, of course, the Fed meeting. Favorable price changes occurred after the Fed statement. The Fed statement was favorable because it didn't really hint at any change in their bond buying program. There had been, as we talked about, after the Fed minutes from the December meeting were released, there had been some discussion about might the Fed be growing more toward a reduction in that bond buying program. At least at this meeting, the statement included no hint that they were changing anything at all. Of course, after the Fed meeting, the weak jobless claims that came out on Thursday caused some weak jobless claims came out early, and then reversal occurred, and unfavorable price changes occurred on Thursday, and then Friday was the big day. You know, the jobs report came out Friday morning early. Prices rallied pretty big after the report came out. They went from down a quarter of a point to up almost a half a point soon after the jobs report came out, which was a little surprising given it wasn't all that weak. You know, it just barely missed the prior months were revised higher. But the nice thing about what was in that jobs report for the market was that the unemployment rate went up. And I say that's nice because, again, that's what the Fed's tied their MBS purchase program to. And instead of a reduction in the unemployment rate, the current report showed an increase in the unemployment rate. So good for the bond buying program again.
Yeah, it looks like that'll continue. With that, based on that news, there's more probability of it continuing.
It could be, but soon thereafter, you know, that all comes out at 8:30 Eastern time. At 10, we had a slew of announcements, including the ISM. All three of the things announced came out better than expected, and all the benefit that we saw from the jobs report, you know, that rise from down 7 to up 14, that 21 point movement, reversed itself. And this one lender had three different unfavorable price changes as it went down Friday afternoon from being up that 14 to back down 7. So anyway, just a volatile week. Hopefully you were able to manage your pipeline through that and not be surprised by any of it.
So
Do
we have a repeat?
No, I hope not. I mean, we're going to have very little on the economic calendar to move the market. You know, the ISM comes out on Wednesday. That's the services index, which isn't as important as the other one. And the jobless claims will come out on Thursday. But other than that, there's not a lot to move the market. And I guess we'll see if this prime minister thing in Spain has an impact on anything. I don't think it will. So I would hope for a quiet week. But like I said early on, we've already seen favorable price changes today. So it's, again, been a volatile day.
It is one of those, again, markets where, you know, the unpredictable. And, you know, Spain, while it may not sound like it's that big a deal, anything that goes on in Europe that creates any concern will have an impact, you know, with what happens in our markets. So it's essential. Joe, I was glued to your service last week. I was absolutely glued to
it. It was a good time to have it.
Well, that's the point. It's what I appreciate most. There's other services that email me stuff and things like that, but there's so much stuff in there that it really doesn't get to the point. What is so effective about MBS Quote Line is that you get to the point of what is most critical and what we need to pay attention to. I appreciate you taking time. Greet everyone there, and just want to tell everybody stay tuned so you can learn more how you can get signed up for MBS Quote Line. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this brief word.
Looking for that competitive edge? MBS Quoteline delivers live market coverage for originators. Get up-to-the-minute mortgage market news and analysis as events occur.
Get MBS prices as trades happen.
Straight to your computer, email, cell phone, or PDA. Know in advance when your investors will reprice. Make better lock-float decisions and increase your income. Be the expert your clients expect and know what's moving interest rates right now, tomorrow, and beyond. MBS Quoteline, delivering live market coverage for originators. Learn more about MBS Quoteline today at MBSQuoteLine.com.
MBSQuoteLine.com.
646-716-4972. The Lincoln on Lending Show is back. Here is your host, David Lincoln.
Good to have you back with us. And we appreciate Alice Alvey bringing us an update and all. But we actually, a special thank you. Alice reached out to Phil Shulman, our guest, a little bit later on the broadcast, asked him to come on the broadcast. I know Phil, I'm very excited to have him here and can't wait to have him add so much color, Alice, to all the things that you give us an update on. And he's got such a deep, rich perspective. I know you're traveling and I think you're mobile right now, but good to have you dialed in and be with the broadcast, Alice.
Well, thanks very much, Dave. You know, as if we don't have enough to worry about with things coming out of the Dodd-Frank Act, we now have FHA finally took the move that we've been expecting. We've certainly known that we were going to get our MIP increases this first quarter, and last week FHA did issue the mortgagee letter to tell us what we knew was going to happen, and now we know for sure a date that the annual MIP is going to increase for all loans by 10 basis points. For loan amounts at $625,000 or less, it's going to be a 10 basis point increase across the board. For loans that are above $625,000, that's just a 5 basis point increase. So a little difference there. Streamlines that were originated prior to May 31st, they're going to remain at their reduced rate for their premium. So that'll be nice. But the biggest thing is going to be the cancellation provisions, too. It's kind of a double whammy here for most of our purchase borrowers. You know, over a 90 LTV, so a 90.01 LTV is going to carry that annual premium for the life of the loan. If you're at a 90 or less, then the annual MIP may drop after 11 years now, not the old five-year mark. So we've got some changes in the MIP that's really going to force some cost analysis in comparison with private mortgage insurance to make sure we're giving customers the right product from a financial standpoint. Then, as if we don't have enough going on with QM, FHA came out with, essentially now we've lost our product that would take a below a 620 credit score. So FHA is essentially saying they want a 620 and a total scorecard, essentially DU and LP, or, you know, today everyone should be, as they're running their loans, are you actually seeing a difference? I haven't had a chance to talk to my customers yet. We'll report on that next week to see what's actually happening in the system. But FHA is saying that they've changed total scorecard, that if you've got a 620, below a 620 credit score or a DTI above 43, you should be getting a refer out of automated underwriting. Now, how many investors are buying refer loans? That's a pretty short list. How many?
It is.
Yeah, how many companies are maybe keeping those in portfolio, putting together their own Jannie Mae pools? There's a few, but this is really going to cause everybody to sit down and look at this a lot more tightly, because there's no way you're getting any protection from the automated underwriting reps and warranties in below 620 or over 43 DTI. So a big change on FHAs when some of those loans, you know, we were still seeing 50 DTI getting approved. So it's a challenge. We've lost that product, and we'll certainly, I think, feel that in the market. The other thing I want to make sure we're letting everybody know is the Mortgage Bankers Association held a conference call for their members and at no charge on LO Comp, and I did get a chance to sit in on that. And a couple of key points I was interested in. You know, certainly I was surprised how many banks were asking questions and concerned about, all right, how much training do I have to do? What do I have to do in a background check? And I mean, really, go just follow the SAFE Act. What are you trying to cut? Right. So the banks out of the QM rule, you know, have to implement tougher standards for the training. And a lot of them were going, well, do I have to train my tellers now? How far does this go? So I think MBA helped clarify that the training can be tailored to the scope of the responsibility, and maybe we can get some more out of that from from Phil as he comes on. The LO comp rule also talks about deferring unexpected increases in costs or anticipated costs. Want to make sure people know you cannot use that reduced compensation for any mistakes or oversights. So be careful as you dissect the LO comp rule. You do have time to post comments till February 25th on the three-point test. There's lots to be dissected on that. To be able to determine what's in 3 points, what's not, and we'll be talking about that on some future shows as well. So it's still unclear on some of the pricing points as we try and get that last part of the final rule or last part of the rule clarified. And so till February 25th, you get to comment. And I think that's my summary for now. February 25th is also the deadline to comment on whether nonprofits and small creditors should be exempt, and also the exemption for the HARP products. So get out there and get your comments posted.
Any sense on, I had someone ask me earlier today, any sense on HARP and HAMP, if any sense of their, from what you can see, Alice, people wanting to, or the policy to continue that? The HARP and HAMP programs. Any sense on that, what you're reading out there, on what you're studying?
Well, from a HARP standpoint, I haven't heard, I think people are still definitely using that program, and I haven't heard anything changing there. Bill's a good person to ask about the HAMP program when he comes on.
Yeah, I can't wait to ask him. He always has a unique perspective on things, and he's definitely dialed in with all the news. But you digest so much data, and there's just so many. I'm looking at all your notes here from the pending updates that are, it's on nonstop, Alice. So what we have coming up this year, there, and I can't wait to get Phil on, and we'll be talking about some of the recent changes. And there is just a avalanche of more and more coming at us. So appreciate it. Alice, thank you so much for taking the time to come on and give us this. And then I know you're going to be a part of the discussion with Phil Shulman here just a little bit. Thank you so much, Alice.
You're welcome.
All right, folks, stay tuned. We'll be right back after this brief word.
Looking for a full-service mortgage training and consulting company to fit exactly what you need? Mortgage U is your ultimate education and information resource used by lenders to execute high-impact, high-quality training throughout the organization. Mortgage U instructors are mortgage professionals
providing classroom and web-based delivery
and has the most sought-after training manuals in the country. Mortgage U has a proven track record performing customized training programs for hundreds and even thousands of employees both live and online on everything from application through loan delivery and insuring. Call Mortgage U today at 800-278-0200 or visit us online at mortgage-u.com. Welcome back to Lickin' on Lending. Our guest call-in line is 646-716-4972. And now here's David Lickin.
Good to have you with us. Appreciate it. And we appreciate the various, so much feedback, all the varied feedback that comes back from us. And it's interesting, as you digest all that's going on, the commentary we get. We appreciate you heading out. You can post your comments on the LinkedIn discussion group, LO Comp. It's a big popular group. It's over 5,000 members, 5,036. I'm proving tens of people, tens and twenties and lots each and every day being on there. A lot of discussion on what's going on, and will be. It's a great place to check what's going on as far as the developments, at least people's attitudes about it. Also, you check out our LinkedIn and our Facebook pages. So encourage you to go there, then get in LinkedIn, and go to David Lickin, and you'll see all the comments about what's going on in the broadcast. And we're increasingly adding more, especially some of our listener feedback. So we really appreciate you letting us know. Bill Coppedge, who is
Hi,
the
Dave.
Creator. Good to have you, Will. Bill, you have one of the most popular blogs and one of the most popular distribution of news that's out there. And so you're reading, you get up at 4:30 every morning, and you're perusing all the news articles, and I'm always interested as to what you think I should be looking at today. So what do you have for our listeners?
Well, it's great to be back. I was away last week, and I missed it. So there.
I know. We missed you.
Okay. The first thing I'd like to talk about today is what I call housing prices in the mortgage banker dilemma. And what I'm about to tell you, I put together after reading articles at Dr. Housing Bubble Blog, OC Housing News, and looking at the Dollar Times Inflation Calculator. And by the way, there is a way you can get links to all of this after all this is over. The peak of the housing market was in 2007. And so I'd like to look at what has happened to the housing market from 2007 till the end of last year, 2012. So the last 5 years, what's been going on? First, is the consumer better off in the last 5 years? Well, from 2007 to 2012, personal income has gone up 5%. However, in the same time period, inflation has gone up 12%. So income's up 5%, inflation up 12%. In real terms, the consumer has fallen behind. They're worse off than they were 5 years ago financially. Now, let's look at the effect of the drop in interest rates engineered by the Fed from 2007 to 2012. In both time periods, I want to look at a $70,000 a year income family, a 34% DTI ratio, which means that they could spend $1,983 a month P&I on a mortgage. The difference between 2007 and 2012 is that 30-year interest rates have almost dropped in half. They've gone from 634 to 366. So because of this interest rate drop, this steep drop, the homeowner's eligible loan amount has risen from $316,000 in 2007 to $429,000 in 2012. In other words, because interest rates have almost gone down by half, consumers can buy a $114,000 more house than they could 5 years ago. And so, you know, to summarize, income up 5%, inflation up 12%. Even though the consumer is worse off, they can buy $114,000 more house now. Okay, so lower interest rates are the real reason that you're seeing a turnaround in housing now. Now, you might have inherently known that, but this is just, you know, quantifying that. So here's the dilemma for mortgage bankers. Today is fat city and fat margins for mortgage bankers. And because of ZIRP and HARP policy, ZIRP being a zero interest rate policy from the Fed, because of ZIRP and HARP, business is great today. Most mortgage bankers that I have talked to are doing about one-third purchase biz and two-thirds refi business. Right. Also, every mortgage banker that I've talked to says they're going to grow their retail presence and purchase business. But my question is, what happens if ZIRP and HARP go away? Well, rates will rise, eligible loan amounts will go down, refis will go away, and originators will all be competing for far fewer borrowers, and there's your dilemma. Less volume for mortgage bankers and a cap on housing prices is what I see. My prediction is this could go on for years. The government will keep doing what they're doing until it no longer works. And mortgage bankers will also keep doing what they're doing right now. When a change finally comes, it will most likely be swift and violent. And is there any way to prepare for what I see as inevitable? I'd like to hear people's thoughts on this. Okay, finally, I'd like to tell you about a white paper that I ran across talking about homeowner associations and homeowner association liens. And the paper was written by a firm called Sperlonga. There are 300,000 homeowner associations in the United States. HUD and Fannie require that liens be settled and current, and if delinquent, the servicer has to advance after 60 days. However, private whole loans and RMBS deals do not have these homeowner association requirements. The average lien deficiency is $7,500. One of the first things that we do at my employer, Faith Servicing, is to check and see if there's a homeowner lien on a delinquent loan. And in many cases, that will make the difference if there's a homeowner lien, if a mod is worth doing or not doing. Anyway, this is a really interesting paper, and I strongly suggest that you take a look. So if you'd like these comments today or the links that they're based on, it's super simple. All you have to do is go to the Lickin' on Lending website where the radio program is. Over on the right, you'll see a picture of me smiling at you with Faith Servicing and Mortgage News Clips. Click that, and you'll have all you need to know about what we talked about today.
ZIRP, that's a new one for me. Zero interest rate
policy.
Policy. There you go. I was looking for the P on there. I was writing it down as fast as you could. What's your sense on the HARP and HAMP, Bill? You read so much. What's your sense?
I do, and you caught me completely unawares on that. I don't really have enough to tell you what I think about it, except I do think that HARP will continue to expand. I don't know if that's going to be, you know, the auspices under which, you know, non-agency loans. There's a lot of talk that the administration might somehow include non-agency loans,
Right.
And then also, and Alice knows this, what about like people that are current on their loans for the last X days now, they can walk away? That's another thing that I read about over the weekend. And but again, you know, I leave that to Alice because that is her bailiwick.
Well, there's just so many changes going on, and I think I was having a discussion earlier today, and I think one of the things that's going to be most impact Harp and Hamp is what happens with housing as we look forward. I think you're right that the Feds can go in and continue ZIRP, the zero interest rate policy, effectively a zero interest rate policy, and I think as long as they do, we're going to see this housing at least not be negatively impacted. The question is are we going to continue with some of these programs to help us work through and some of the what could become inventory down the road, some foreclosure. It's interesting. Bill, thank you so much for doing it. Greet all our friends there at Faith Servicing. We appreciate you bringing to us an update on what's happening. And
glad to
have you back. I'm glad to have you back. I hope to have
Thanks,
you.
Dave.
You can travel, but just you just got to come on. It's nice having your recorded voice, but it's just so much more effective to have you here. Folks, we'll be right back after this brief break.
In today's climate, quality counts more than ever, and Wetzel's Trot can help your company maintain the quality that you require to survive in an ever-changing market. With over 450 customers across the country, Wetzel's Trot has specialized in quality control reviews for residential lenders since 1985. Wetzel's Trot can assist your organization in maintaining a high standard of quality within your residential mortgage operation. They offer a wide variety of services, including loan quality control, servicing quality control, quality control plans, fraud review services, and even web-based quality control software. Quality is never an accident. It is always the result of high intention, sincere effort, intelligent direction, and skillful execution. Choosing Wetzel's Trot represents the wise choice of many alternatives. Contact Wetzel's Trot today for details at 248-592-2252. Wetzel's Trot, the single source solution for your quality control needs.
And now, broadcasting live from Austin, Texas, we're back with the Lickin' on Lending Show.
Good to have you back with us. Appreciate it. The Profit Doctor is out making house calls again. It is a busy time for the Profit Doctor. He is traveling. I've never seen him gone as much as he is. But there's a lot of folks really focusing in on their bottom line and going, you know what? I like these margins. I want to bet. I think the biggest thing that's going on out there is everyone's starting to, because of the volumes that are there, they're getting stuck in a fixed cost structure. And one of the things the Profit Doctor is always talking about is how do, when the market turns, when Joe publishes that news that just causes the market to have a seizure, we stop the volume going in quite at the rates that it has been. How do you adjust that bottom line? So the Profit Doctor, he hopes to be back here next week if he can stay off an airplane flying around the country and fixing things. But appreciate it, and safe travels to the Profit Doctor as he's traveling around. Also, Tony Garitano is out. Love to get an update of what's going on. There is a lot happening when it comes to technology. Appreciate Tony being with us on the broadcast. But we have a special guest today that I want to give as much time to as possible. Phil Shulman is a partner in a law firm, K&L Gates, very well-known, well-established, huge company, huge law firm. And Phil used to be at FHA and has been supporting the mortgage industry with his legal services and his knowledge about how FHA operates. If you ever run into an issue with FHA, if you're running into an issue wanting to know and need legal representation, Phil is a great guy and a resource that many, many mortgage bankers have turned to. Phil, I just want to say welcome to the broadcast and appreciate you taking time out of your very busy day to share with our listeners all that's going on. And we have so much to talk about, it's not even funny. Good to have you with us.
All right. Thank you, David.
In the past 4 weeks, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has released a slew of new regulations and all the specific prohibitions on what can be done and what can't be done, the requirements. How did the industry find itself here? I mean, give us that view from the higher altitudes. How did the industry find themselves in this predicament, Phil?
Well, if you're asking how do we get so over-regulated, I guess the answer is more obvious than unexpected. You know, we came through a decade of sort of a laissez-faire, anything-goes attitude, really, by Congress, by the regulators, by Wall Street, by investors, even consumers. But then, of course, subprime bubble burst. We all knew it would, but we partied on, and that up and went. And, of course, when that happens, Congress feels like it's upon them to step in and control risk. And that's what they did here. They attempted to control every aspect of risk. They looked at each of the factors that they thought contributed to that economic downfall. They stepped up enforcement, and they put greater accountability and liability on the lenders. And, of course, they did all of that through the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act of 2010. And, of course, the centerpiece of that consumer protection is that super agency, the Bureau.
It is the Bureau, the big Bureau. And I tell you, I've never seen anything grow so quickly and so have such a dramatic effect on us. It's clear that the power, there's been a power shift, but there's also some controversy about this. Phil, get into some of the controversy. I mean, even literally down to Cordray's appointment now is being called in question. Love to get your perspective on that.
All right, let me do both, because it is both powerful and controversial. I mean, in terms of powerful, I think it's an understatement, really. This is an Uber agency. They are charged with oversight of 18 separate consumer financial protection statutes. I mean, you string any couple letters of the alphabet together, and you'll come up with some consumer protection statute, and you'll find that the Bureau is in charge. So whether it's HMDA or RESPA or TILA or Gramm-Leach-Bliley or FCRA or on and on and on, they got to take staff from six different agencies. They have nearly an unlimited budget. And on top of that, it's like they have nuclear power in terms of their arsenal of weaponry. So they can cause rescissions and refunds. They can cause lenders to make restitution, to pay damages. You violate those consumer statutes, and they're coming to get you. And in terms of just dollar penalties, starts at $5,000 a day, and if they determine that you knowingly violated these statutes, it can be penalties up to $1 million a day. So if they want to bring a company to their knees, they have that kind of firepower. On top of that, and we know this in D.C., and I know this from my old days at HUD, if we wanted to bring a lawsuit at HUD, we had to go hat in hand to the Department of Justice and ask them if they would bring a lawsuit on our behalf. The Bureau doesn't have to do that. They have the power to march into court, federal district court, on their own. So they're a force to be reckoned with. You mentioned the controversy, and I assume what you're talking about is
yes.
Last week, the district court for the Circuit Court of Appeals here in Washington, D.C., found that President Obama's recess appointments for three board members from the National Labor Relations Board were unconstitutional, that he didn't have the right to appoint these people because there wasn't a recess in effect at that moment in time. And the reason that that comes back to haunt the CFPB and raise concern is because Richard Cordray was appointed on the same day under the same circumstances
as the
three NLRB members.
Yeah,
so,
I think that is a significant data point, and would like to get your thoughts. A lot of our listeners that are listening to it, and then Alice, I'm going to toss the mic over to you for a bit. But a lot of our listeners are saying, does this mean that, you know, Cordray is going to be gone? And if he's gone, do all these regulations they've passed, are they basically unconstitutional, or do we have to go back to zero? I mean, I don't sense the latter, but what's your thoughts?
Well, good question. I guess, look, first of all, this lawsuit involved the National Labor Relations Board. It didn't involve the Bureau. It is a district court, circuit court of appeals decision. It doesn't cover the entire United States the way a Supreme Court decision would. But that said, I think the administration is in a precarious position because there is a live lawsuit by a bank from Texas questioning Cordray's appointment. And it would not be out of the realm of possibility for the courts to again rule as they did in the NLRB case and say that this appointment was unconstitutional. And so the administration's got a choice. They can either duke it out in court, or they're going to have to reach some kind of a compromise with the Republicans. And the Republicans are not big fans of the Bureau for two reasons. One, they don't like the single director. That they feel that's too much power in the hands of one person, and I guess if they're not the ones picking the director, it's way too much power. And second, and this really irks them, they don't control the Bureau's purse strings. The Bureau gets its money from the Federal Reserve Board budget, and so they want to see a commission like the SEC or the FTC, and they want to see Congress controlling the purse strings. So the administration may have to compromise on some of these structural and procedural methods for running that Bureau, or they're going to have to duke it out. But let me address the final question, and I know you have others, but look, my advice to your listeners, the regs that came out, and we're going to talk about them in a couple of minutes, almost all of them take effect a year from now, not till January of 2014, and by that time, this thing's going to get settled. So my advice to your listeners, gear up to follow these regs.
Exactly what we've been telling them. Alice? Oh, go ahead, Alice.
But,
Joe Farr, yes.
Yeah, I just wanted, before we left that question, Phil, would your advice be to anyone out there like that small Texas bank that's got this lawsuit? Is this something we ought to pursue, or should we avoid it? Because if the suit goes on, whatever the Republicans and Obama do in negotiating how it's structured may be irrelevant.
Well, the court could end up saying it's unconstitutional. If it's unconstitutional, the Department of Treasury then, I think, under the Dodd-Frank Act, would then run the agency on a temporary basis. What it would mean, though, is that the Bureau would not be able to create regulations for non-large banks, that is, banks and mortgage companies with less than $10 billion in assets, and some of their enforcement would have to take a back seat until they got a director. So it could impact the way they do business, but you've got to believe that they're going to get this thing straightened out before that happens.
Yeah, I would suspect that. Definitely that's been my hunch. Alice, let's go over to you. I know you've got so many regulations and so many things that you study each and every week that I just know you'd love to ask Phil about.
Well, yeah, because I think we were chewing on the what-if scenario with CFPB, so I think you answered that. That's great. I'd want to hear your thoughts on the ability to repay. And really, I know we should be preparing for it, but we've got this protection as long as it's a Fannie Freddie loan that, you know, we're going to be okay. But what should lenders be doing, and what are your thoughts on the ability to repay? Do we always have to assess the borrower's ability to repay anyway, and there's no real change here?
Well, the concept of an ability to repay, and that is a creditor determining that there's a reasonable basis for the borrower to repay that mortgage, should be one of the foundations of any underwriter in any company. But
I agree.
But the ability to repay rule was in effect already. It was first initiated in connection with high-cost mortgages, with the HOPA loans. But what the Dodd-Frank Act did is it took that concept, which was applying to second mortgages and refis, and said it now applies to all covered transactions, all purchase money mortgages. So if you're making a loan in this country to a borrower on a dwelling, then you, as a lender, are obligated to make sure that that borrower has a reasonable ability to repay. And if you don't, a whole lot of bad things are going to happen to you, not the least of which is there's no statute of limitations for the borrower crying at a foreclosure proceeding that, hey, this lender didn't make a determination that I could repay because, look, I wouldn't be here if he got it right. I shouldn't have had that loan. It was too much for me to afford. So what this statute does is it extends the ability to repay to all covered transactions, but it provides this qualified mortgage, which is an exemption or exception that allows a lender to sleep at night.
So the general requirements, do you want to go over those for everybody? We've talked about them a little bit in the past, but I'd like to hear your perspective on the requirements.
Sure. you know, this is 804 pages of regulation, but I can thumbnail sketch it down to 30 seconds. How's that? Look, let's keep in mind.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
Well, the answer always when it comes to the Bureau, if you want to thumbnail sketch it down to 30 seconds, the answer is no, 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 and don't even think about it. But
stop right there, Phil? Because really, how many people are going to go there? These changes, how many people do you anticipate going to there? You know what? The easy answer is just don't.
Well, the answer is if you want to make loans in this country, you're going to have to consider the reasonable ability to repay. But when I go through the general requirements in a minute, they're not going to shock anybody. They're what any prudent lender would do if they were going to approve a borrower. But let's start at the beginning, which was really why even have this rule. And I think the thought was, at least by Congress and now by the Bureau, that too many borrowers got stuck in loans that they were doomed to fail. There was no way they could afford them. You know, whether it was junk loans or no docs or negative AM or option arms or whatever. And the thought was that lenders were not verifying the borrower's income and debts, and they were using these teaser rates to get them in the door. So the Dodd-Frank Act says you don't get to make a loan to a borrower unless you can prove that there's a reasonable good faith determination that the guy can repay the debt. And they give you four ways to meet that criteria. You can comply with the ability to repay rules. You can make a qualified mortgage, which automatically, in most circumstances, gets you home free. You can refinance a toxic subprime loan into a standard loan. Or if you're a small creditor in the rural area or underserved area, you can make a certain kind of balloon loan. But to answer your question very quickly, Alice, if you and I sat down and said to a lender, we need you to come up with a standard for underwriting, you would include eight criteria, and they would be looking at the current and reasonably expected income and assets, looking at the debt obligations, looking at employment, looking at credit history, taking a look at what impact the monthly payment is going to have on overall housing expenses. So there's nothing there that is exceptional or unusual for lenders to comply with. It's the penalties that'll kill you.
Yeah. Exactly. Those penalties are just over the top. Let's cover those. Some of the penalties are. I mean, are you seeing any of these penalties actually be assessed?
Well, Truth in Lending. So what this does is this amends the Truth in Lending Act, and the Truth in Lending Act has penalties in it already. So what they're saying is these penalty provisions in Truth in Lending are now going to apply to those of you who make loans where the consumer does not have a reasonable ability to repay. So what are those? Actual damages.
Right.
There are statutory damages of up to $4,000 per transaction. Consumer can get his finance charges back. If he had hired an attorney, he can get his attorney's fees covered. And if he's in a foreclosure proceeding, he can raise as a defense that the consumer was offered a loan that he didn't have a reasonable ability to repay. And the way that you measure that is basically you're going to look at his reserves. After he gets done paying all of his monthly obligations, his mortgage payment and so forth, kind of front-end and back-end ratio stuff, is there enough money there for him to live on and to pay his other expenses? And if the court determined that there wasn't, then you have a problem. That's why, as a lender, you have to make a qualified mortgage. Otherwise, you can't sleep at night.
Well, I just think it's so difficult to really define that because we don't get piece of cake loan files all the time for how income is calculated. So it starts to feel that the door is always open to make a case if you've got someone who had two or three different types of employment or they're self-employed and income calculations aren't straightforward, that anyone looking at multiple docs at the time of the loan file could, in hindsight, go, oh, I think you overestimated the income, you know, and therefore we're coming up with the DTI was really this when you thought it was in compliance. So do you see that kind of drilling down post, you know, at very late, you know, years after the loan closed?
Well, that's a good introduction to QM because, really, another way of saying that, Alice, is you and I could look at the same loan And I could say the guy's a good bet to repay it, and you say no because underwriting can be subjective. Or you've approved 20 loans with a guys with very similar credit profiles, and 19 out of the 20 have done just fine, and this guy didn't. Now he's going to be able to come into court 5 years later and say, shouldn't have made this loan to me. That's why lenders said to Congress, we're not going to be able to make a loan unless you give us some kind of safe harbor, unless you give us some way of sleeping at night. And so the way they did that was by saying to the creditors, if you make a qualified mortgage, then we will presume that the consumer had an ability to repay. And what they did is they created two tests, a conclusive, absolutely sleep-at-night test for covered transactions. These are standard prime loans. If you make a qualified mortgage on a standard prime loan, then you have met the safe harbor and a consumer can't come back at you 5 years later. If it's a high-cost covered transaction, that is a point and a half above APOR for first lien and 3.5 points above APOR for subordinate liens, then you can make the QM, but the consumer can come into court and try to rebut the presumption. So two ways to try to come at it. But as far as the qualifications, they're basically the ATR qualifications I read to you, but two others that are giving the industry acid indigestion. One is points and fees can't exceed 3% on a QM loan, and also the debt-to-income ratio cannot exceed 43%. There are exceptions if you, as Alice said, if you make a FHA or a VA loan, a rural housing loan, if you make a Fannie or Freddie loan, they're presumed to be QM-type protections, and so you're okay until the agencies write their own QM rules or 7 years from January of 2014, either one of those. So it's a temporary exemption for government loans.
Now,
you've
got
to make a QM. You have to make a QM or you're subject to attack.
Yeah. Well, it just seems like there's so much. We do a lot of legal expert witness work. We're in a lot of cases out there, Phil, and it just seems like job security all over for those of us who are either protecting or testifying on behalf of this. It's just a massive job security. And before I forget this point, I have, for the listeners, I want to let you to know, I had a client that hired Brand X law firm to represent them in a matter. And it was, they brought me in and said, this isn't going well. What do you do? And I said, go get Hire Phil. Unfortunately, it was a day late and a dollar short. He gave them advice, but he can make such a difference when you're arguing some of these issues. Get the right advice up front. Get it before you get into trouble. You should have these reviewed. Alice is a great resource. Phil is a great resource. Phil, sorry for jumping in there. I wanted to just make sure our listeners know just my confidence in you as I've watched you advise our clients that have gotten into some issues. And just the wisdom that comes out and how they could have saved themselves literally $1,000. In one case, one company had to go out of business because they didn't retain you and they got bad counsel beforehand. So 2 cents for you to jump into that. Alice, anything more before I toss the mic over to Joe?
Well, actually, no, I was just going to say I want to hear Joe. I know Joe had a question for Phil, and I'm anxious to hear the answer to that. So, Joe, fire away.
Joe hit the mute button by mistake there. So, Joe? Well, maybe
Joe.
Well,
listen, that was an easy question to answer. The answer is no.
Oh, here it is. He sent it to you in an email, I think, Phil. So, you know, it was about the idea of risk. You know, did this really make a lot more risk? So do you have that question in front of you that Joe had sent?
Well, he was asking, I think, when we had a discussion last week as to whether or not this whole ATR ability to repay is something new or has it always been there? And I think, as I said, the answer is it's been expanded. But I don't know how much time we have left, but I think it's worth a couple of minutes. And I know Alice...
We got about 7 minutes, so let's keep on going.
All right, because I want to end with talking about quality control and internal controls in the area where Alice makes her bread and butter, because if you don't kick the tires and you don't make sure that you've dotted your I's and crossed your T's, it's too late when the regulators come in to do it for you. So we'll get to that.
Yeah, there's no question about that. I would like to get a little bit into as much as you can on LO compensation rules, and there's been so much controversial discussion going on in that, but can you briefly help our lenders get some idea what they can expect when it comes to LO comp?
Well, again, this was 500 pages that just came out. I geared up for a webinar last week on ATR. That was 804 pages, so I'm about 500 pages behind, but a lot of the final rule here is similar to the proposed rule that was out before. And again, you have to kind of go back to, well, why are they getting into our business? Why does Congress care how we pay our people? Well, the reason they have concerns are twofold. One, they think that there was very little training and expertise from these loan officers who were taking applications. And more important, they said there's no question that loan officers were steering borrowers to more expensive loans because they got higher commissions. And so the way they tried to address this in Dodd-Frank and now the Bureau through their regs was twofold. One, they created loan officer standards and training. And two, they said, you can't pay a loan officer based on the terms of the loan. So you've got to say to an LO, listen, loan originator, for the next quarter, for the next 6 months, whatever your period is, we're paying you 85 basis points. That's 85 basis points on an FHA loan, a VA loan, an ARM, a graduated payment, a jumbo. You're getting the same 85%. And the thought was, if we do that, then the loan officer is going to steer the consumer to the best loan because they're going to make the same amount of money. But it raises so many issues about what do you do if you're a mortgage broker, and can you pay your loan officer, and how do you pay them? And, of course, there's also a prohibition against dual compensation. So if you're a mortgage broker, you either get paid by the lender or you get paid by the consumer, but you can't get paid by both. And so what we've seen happen in the industry is that it's the lender who pays the mortgage broker. There's some crazy stuff in here, which I hope gets changed, but we mentioned this three-point cap on qualified mortgages, and there's a dual counting in there, which is driving everyone crazy, and that is if a lender pays a mortgage broker 2 points for that loan, the 2 points would get counted against the three-point cap. But then when the mortgage broker pays his loan officer a point, that point also gets counted. So it's like you're double counting the same money, and before you know it, you've tripped the 3% tolerance. So the board recognizes that. It came out of the statute, and they've said, give us some comment on that. Let us think about it. I'm hoping they'll use their exception or exemption powers to not double count. There's a rule against binding arbitration clauses. You can't put them in there. And as Alice was talking, look, if you're a bank, your loan officers have to register with the NMLS, this National Mortgage Lending System.
Yeah, the National Mortgage Lending Service, yeah.
But if you're a loan officer for a mortgage banker, then you have to actually get licensed. And so what the statute said is, hey, bank, just because your loan officers don't have to get licensed doesn't mean they don't have to have training and experience. And we want you to follow the same kind of requirements for that the SAFE Act does for loan officers who work for mortgage companies. And as Alice said, it's not that difficult. It's not rocket science. But the point is, banks, you got to do it.
You got to do it. I think we got Joe Farr back on live. He disappeared for a while there. We got one question answered that you emailed him. So we got that covered. So come on, Joe.
Well, along the same regards, when you're talking about the broker environment where the broker fee and the broker's comp to his LO would be counted, I've heard that that'd be true on the retail environment too, where the origination fee would be counted and then compensation paid to the LO, that is the employee of the lender. Is that true?
Well, first of all, 2 points are paid as true discount points, so they're not going to count. If you're a loan officer for a mortgage company, then no, the points that the lender's getting aren't going to get counted if they're up to the 2 points. So you don't have the double counting that you do with a mortgage broker. That's where the real problem comes in. But I think the Bureau is going to correct it.
Yeah, good. Because somebody was saying that benefits like annual sales rewards trips would be counted in the cost of the compensation.
Yes, but they are going to allow certain bonuses, like pooled bonuses for the whole office, and they'll allow you to contribute toward the loan officer's 401k without tripping that LO comp prohibition. So there are some exceptions.
Good. Well, I think some people are trying to watch for the idea of compensation that is paid that is foreseeable to be paid versus compensation that's not foreseeable. And so how do you plan then for what has to get included in the points? And is there a way
there's a whole section. There's a whole section, and geez, it's probably under 100 pages, but there's a whole section in there that says normally when the rule came out in proposed form, it said a loan officer could not agree to eat some of his commission in order
right.
to get the loan. He still had to get paid his 85 basis points. The lender had to eat it. Now what they're saying is if the reason for the increased cost was unforeseen or some mistake by the loan officer, they'll allow the loan officer to cover that. You know, like if you said that the loan was locked and it wasn't, and so there was some cost involved, now you can nick the loan officer, whereas previously you couldn't. But it's
so
still
that's a clarification. Yeah, okay, good. I mean, Joe, I got a couple of questions I want to get in, but I want to make sure you disappeared
there
for a while.
Good.
Anything else you have?
No, go ahead.
All right, I want to talk about FHA for a minute. With some of the changes that have just been announced, what are your thoughts on this? Is this the last of it, Phil, or is there going to be more changes? Is this a creeping something that's going to have creep more conservative with time as FHA and fund struggles to stay liquid? Or stay solvent?
Well, it has become more and more difficult for lenders to participate in the FHA program and more expensive for consumers to. And their market share has dropped. I mean, at one point it went from 3% to about 32%. I think it's around 20% of the market now, but maybe some of the people on the panel would know better. The answer is FHA has become extremely enforcement-minded, teaming up with the U.S. Attorney's offices under the False Claims Act, all kinds of indemnifications for anybody in the LI program. So there's so much more accountability to participate in FHA that when the market does turn, I'm sure a lot of lenders will look for other means of trying to make a dollar. But for the moment, if you want to play in the FHA arena, you better make sure you follow those handbook requirements and mortgagee letters because they're not taking any prisoners over there.
No, they're not. But if I tell you, everybody, if you do have an issue, call Phil. He's the best representative you could ever hope to have.
I'll tell you something. I'm not going to disagree with you on that. I know my wife considers Phil Shulman one of the best attorneys she knows. So I thank you for the plug, Joe. I mean, David.
Yeah,
Joe,
Joe
didn't plug me at all, by the way. But, David, thank you.
I agree with David.
I agree.
That's why I like
one last question for you. Phil, what keeps you beyond the regulation, what keeps you awake in a few seconds? What keeps you awake at night as it relates to the industry and your clients involved in this industry?
I'm concerned about my guys who do this deer in the headlights routine when they call me and say, I can't believe it. These guys showed up from the Bureau today or from FHA, and they want all of my records. They want all of my emails. Do I have to give them this stuff? And doesn't everybody violate a couple of rules occasionally? And I say to them, it is so expensive to get yourself in the middle of these investigations that they give you the answers. The Bureau tells you when we come out to do an exam, these are the areas we're going to look at. You'd be nuts not to do your own internal review or due diligence, either by yourself or by an outside firm. And that's what keeps me up at night is the fact that these guys have an opportunity to make sure that they don't get themselves in trouble and they don't take full advantage of it. So I'm a big proponent of quality control.
Want to get a hold of Phil? We're at the end of the broadcast. Get a hold of Phil by going to calling him at 202-778-9027. Folks, thank you so much for being a part of the broadcast. We are out of time, and I want to say thank you, Phil, for being a part of the broadcast. Have a great week, everybody.
This has been Lickin' on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update with your host, David Lickin of Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level. Today's guests were Joe Farr from MBS Quoteline, Andy Schell of Mortgage Banking Solutions, and Alice Alvey, President CMB of Mortgage U. Come by next week, and thank you for listening.